Good evening. Thanks, everybody, for coming out this evening. It's hard to do in the evening now that it's getting dark again so early. And if you haven't seen it already, do not miss that super moon. This is the closest that the moon will be to us in the past 70 years. It's really quite remarkable. So thanks for joining us. I'll introduce myself. I'm clinical associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Nursing in the Department of Psychiatry. Other service-related roles are as president of the International Nurses Society on Addictions. But what brings me and us here is my role as co-chair for the Washtenaw Health Initiative Opioid Project. So how many among the audience have even heard of the Opioid Project? Precious few, and that's exactly why we're here. So thank you, because we're doing some really important work, and it's important that that you as community members know and understand what that is, and we hope that we'll garner your support, and in whatever capacity that you're able to provide that, some degree of participation, even if that is as an informed citizen. So my counterpart in this role is Marcy Scalera. And applause is fine. Yeah. So Marcy's position is as Director of Clinical and Substance Use Disorder Services, and this is for a four-county regional area as well, so a large territory. The objectives for this evening is for us to review some of the national and local statistics related to opioid use, overdoses, and opioid overdose-related deaths. How many among the audience, even those of you who are not yet familiar with the Opioid Project, are familiar that we are in the midst of an opioid epidemic? Now all the hands come up. And even a more difficult question, how many among us have known or known of somebody who has died from an opioid-related overdose? Again, the vast majority of the audience. To explore factors that have contributed to this opioid epidemic, key features of the Washtenaw Health Initiative, or WHI Opioid Project, to learn about a specific successful initiative that's grown out of this project, identify actions that you can take as citizens, and then we hope to have plenty of time for questions, answers, and discussion. So I'm told that my overview or presentation time will be about 25 minutes, if that, and then we'll switch over to a panel discussion. I'll briefly introduce our panel members. During that time, I'll be looking through some of the questions as well and help to serve as a moderator for the question and answer piece. So please don't be shy about asking any and all questions that you're interested in. As we were discussing before we gathered, among the five of us, we can probably answer any question that you can put our way, or at least make something reasonable up in a pinch. So there are numerous graphs, charts, representations that reflect the great number of the increases in opioid overdose deaths gradually since 2000, but really quite dramatically in just these past several or few years. And you can see deaths rated per 100,000 in the population moving from 3 per 100,000 to nearly triple that, 9 per 100,000 just within recent years. Well, what does that mean in real numbers? And in real numbers, those are staggering. That some of the most recent data that have been released from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, is at a rate of 48,000 deaths per year, more than doubled just within these past few years. It appears that opioid overdose-related deaths are a function, at least in part, of our prescribing practices, the number of prescriptions that have been written since 1999 until 2014 have quadrupled, as have the total doses of opioids medications across all adults in the United States. At present, the overdose rates are estimated to be at approximately, there was a theme of 129 a day. I don't know how long that number is going to stay fixed because we have not yet seen an overall reversal in these. But if you do the math for that, what that comes down to is that in the amount of time that we're together this evening, in just 90 minutes, the better part of 10 people will die of an opioid overdose here in the United States. 10 people. So that would eliminate essentially one entire row out of tonight's audience on both sides. These numbers now exceed the number of individuals who die on an annual basis from motor vehicle accidents. There were enough prescriptions written in the past year to supply every single adult in the United States with a bottle of opioid medications. In addition to that, we're seeing increased rates of use among even more deadly compounds. We'll talk about those in just a minute, including fentanyl and carfentanyl. Thanks. A few months ago, a talk was given by an author, Sam Canonis, who's an investigative journalist, most of whose work has been done in Mexico. He's written a book, and I have no commercial interests, as a disclaimer. I have no commercial interests in this book or anything else that we'll be talking about this evening. But he weaves an absolutely riveting tale around how it is that we find ourselves now in the midst of this opioid epidemic. So some might call that almost a perfect storm when you consider the factors that when they've collided have created this catastrophe and crisis in individual communities and across the nation. So he focuses on one community in particular and tells the story of a town that had an area that was called Dreamland. Some of the contributing factors. And you're going to hear some of these echoed now by the 19th Surgeon General of the United States in just a few minutes. Lack of adequate training to medical personnel regarding the use of opioids and a misperceived safety associated with that. There was very aggressive marketing, by pharma to physicians and other prescribers. Opioids were touted as being absolutely safe, and that if individuals were receiving opioid medications for pain, that they could not become addicted. All of this was predicated on a one-paragraph letter I believe it was the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, which was really an observational study about patients, not in general, but under highly supervised circumstances, including hospitalizations. That was used, as the rationale for the widespread and liberal prescribing of opioid medications for pain. Here's an interesting piece of science and data to consider for that, though. There's little or no evidence that opioid medications are effective for chronic pain, for which the vast majority of individuals receive these medications. It's wonderful for acute pain, especially post-surgical, and for cancer pain as well. So the notion is not that we want to withhold medications from patients who appropriately are receiving those, but the fact is that the vast majority are administered to individuals for complaints of chronic pain. And that, in fact, is a physiological phenomenon that shows that the continued use of opioids over which we build a tolerance means that we don't have the same therapeutic effect from it in very rapid fashion. That many people develop what's called hyperalgesia, meaning that their pain threshold lowers and they become even more sensitive to pain, and that, in fact, opioid medications make pain worse over time, not better, which is why you hear so many times people who are in feeling almost imprisoned by their chronic pain still rating their pain very high, even though they're taking increasingly larger doses of these medications and potentially putting themselves at risk of overdose. There were unscrupulous pill mills. There was an entire corridor then that started really there at the base of Appalachia, and ran down and through the state of Florida, where prescribers were writing prescriptions nearly as quickly as they physically could, with little or no physical examination of the patient, and unleashing tens of thousands of prescriptions and doses into our communities. At the same time, there was a shift in the market in terms of heroin, and what had previously been white powdered heroin, coming predominantly from Asia or areas of the Middle East, was being supplanted by very cheap, very high-quality black tar heroin from a very small region in Mexico. And Mr. Quinones tells the tale of how it is that this infiltrated. He likened it to mass marketing, kind of like selling pizzas. Really high customer service. This was in the day when young men would come up and drive inconspicuous cars, deliver, answer to a pager, and it was a very efficient system. If they were caught, they were simply sent back to Mexico. In the medical system, although it was well-intended, we're paying the consequences for it now. And I heard a physician at our opioid summit that we held here, sponsored by the University of Michigan back in October, and there was a physician there who said, described the current opioid epidemic as an iatrogenic effect, and that means something that happens to somebody when they're receiving medical care. So if somebody goes into a hospital, for example, and they get an infection, that's an untoward outcome that you're not looking for. And then, in fact, that explains to some degree the opioid epidemic in which we find ourselves now, was that we designated pain as the fifth vital sign. And said that pain should always be assessed, and that a real focus of patient care was on whether or not pain was being adequately treated. And that patient satisfaction surveys actually became linked to this. And to some degree, the clinicians or practitioners, clinics, found themselves feeling as if they were being held hostage, being threatened by patients if they didn't receive the medications that they felt that they wanted or needed. In many treatment settings, by otherwise truly compassionate providers, it was just easier to write a script than it was to put up an argument. In addition, because we've become so reliant on prescribing opioids to address pain, it was really we were a one-trick pony. And in the meantime, then few or no dollars, national research dollars, were being put into trying to identify alternative ways to treat pain, because it was, and insurance companies also refused to pay for alternative treatments because it was so much quicker, easier, faster, simply to write a script. Go ahead, Matt. So when talking about opioids, the formulation is an important factor. Many medications then are described in terms of what are called their morphine equivalents. How many times more potent are they than morphine? So heroin is twice as potent as morphine. Oh, one of the other interesting factors that happen when individuals, maybe for legitimate pain, were started on prescription opioid medications. A phenomenon that we've seen in recent years that had never happened before is that heroin became cheaper than prescription opioids, even on the street. For example, an OxyContin was not an uncommon price would be $1 per milligram. So if you were taking a high dose tablet of that at 80 milligrams, that pill was worth $80. Well, you can buy heroin more cheaply than that. So for the first time, we saw patients which we'd never seen before in addictions treatment. I've been in this field for nearly 25 years, that people who were started on prescription medications ended up converting them to heroin use. So interesting story around heroin. So our current opioid epidemic is not our first misstep by a long shot. Heroin was actually created by the Bayer pharmaceutical company as a safe, non-addictive treatment to address morphine dependence. Yeah, so we've missed the boat more than once on this one. More recently, and this is reflected in some of our local statistics as well, fentanyl, a very powerful analgesic, has also now been mixed in at increasing rates with heroin, resulting in markedly increased rates of overdoses. And it's not hard to imagine when you look at the fact that fentanyl is 100 times more potent than morphine, 100 times. So now, if that were not terrifying enough, and fentanyl has played an increasingly larger role in the overdose deaths even in our own community as well as across the country. Just very recently, there have been pockets across the country where a drug called carfentanil has been introduced. Carfentanil, it literally is designed to take down, to bring down large animals like elephants. So it's 10,000 times more powerful than morphine. And, of course, then the rates of overdose deaths associated with this drug are exceedingly high. Just a few weeks ago in a community in Ohio, 20 individuals died of overdoses in the same weekend. And in a bit, I'll introduce you to Lieutenant Lisa King, and we were talking just before the beginning of our time this evening, and she mentioned that that there was just very recently a confirmed carfentanil-related death in one of our surrounding communities as well. In a recent letter from our 19th Surgeon General, Dr. Murthy, he echoes many of those very same themes that that were identified by Mr. Kanonis in his book. And he says, I am asking you, and he means all of us, I'm asking you for help to solve an urgent healthcare crisis facing America, the opioid epidemic. We arrived at this place on a path paved with good intentions. Nearly two decades ago, we were encouraged to be more aggressive about treating pain, often without enough training and support to do so safely. This coincided with heavy marketing of opioids to doctors. Many of us were even taught, incorrectly, that opioids are not addictive when prescribed for legitimate pain. The results have been devastating. So you hear how many of those themes that we heard from the book Dreamland by Kanonis are now being echoed by our own Surgeon General. So what's happening locally? This is a problem that we've had our finger on the pulse to some degree for at least a couple years, and since about 2013. But things became much more focused and intentional just within this past year or so. In response to what we were seeing in terms of spiking rates of opioid-related overdose deaths, and I'll show you some statistics that are very specific to residents of Washtenaw County, we convened, invited and convened a community gathering. There were representatives across any number of diverse institutions, positions across the county. So it included, for example, treatment providers, law enforcement, clergy, physicians, nurses, educators, coming together to see if we couldn't band together to generate a community response. That there were more than 100 of us there. This was graciously hosted for those who some may recognize that is the barn at Dawn Farm. And it holds more than 100 people very comfortably. And it was a really exciting gathering together. And something important was launched as a result of that. So that was in August 2015. And to the left, you'll see I introduced you to Marcy Scalera already. And behind her is Fred Brayson. And Fred actually is the progenitor of a model that we've since adopted. It's called the opioid or the Lazarus Project. So Fred had no previous experience in addictions treatment whatsoever. He was a chaplain, but his community was one of the first in North Carolina that was completely and utterly devastated by the opioid epidemic, an entire community that was destroyed up and, by the effects of this crisis. So there are in the hub of this then are some of the more central considerations, including why we're all here with you tonight. And the first of those is public awareness, that none of us is going to be able to achieve any of these important goals independently. It really does require a concerted community effort. If you're waiting for somebody else to do this for you, we're never going to have a handle on this. There are things that each and every one of us can do to contribute to this cause. Most of us feel so strongly about this. I don't think I mentioned that just the structure for the opioid project. We're fortunate to have the Washtenaw Health Initiative here in Washtenaw County. It is, however, a volunteer agency. There are certain special interest groups, including the mental health and substance use work group. That, too, has leaders from the community, including past presidents of each of the major healthcare systems here. But that, too, is purposefully volunteer with no financial stream, no steady financial stream whatsoever. We made a conscious decision not even to become a 501(c)(3) nonprofit. So nestled under that, then, is the Washtenaw Health Initiative Opioid Project. We're very fortunate to be able to benefit from some administrative and logistical support through what's called CHART, the Center for Health Research and Transformation. Around this hub, then, of public awareness, coalition action, data and evaluation, including data that we get from the medical examiner for Washtenaw County, as well as an epidemiologist who presented again to our group that this morning. We meet once a month on the third Tuesday of each month. Around that hub, then, are certain spokes, including, for example, provider education. So I'm going to just touch very quickly on the way around the wheel to let you know about a few initiatives, not any. These are just some samples of some work that's being done. We consider ourselves to be the Opioid Project, really to be a coordinating and communicating agency. There is a website, and we'll make you familiar with that before we go. We want to see. There's been a lot of independent work being done. But if it's all done in an uncoordinated fashion, it makes it more difficult for us to really be able to focus, to respond in a focused way, which is part of what we're looking for through our work together. So provider education can include, for example, what are more reasonable prescribing practices. At the University of Michigan, the Institute of Health Innovation, there are a band of surgeons, for example, who have been examining data across the state related to prescribing of opioids, and they've come across a really astounding finding. That is that among opioid-naive patients who receive surgery, that is, patients who weren't already taking opioid medications, that the single most common side effect is not infections, as most of us might think, but it is subsequent chronic opioid use. In terms of hospital ED policies, we're very happy to have in our team physicians from each of the two major health providers, and they are looking to coordinate some of their prescribing practices because oftentimes emergency departments are one of the points of access in the community. Diversion control. This takes many different forms. So among them, I have a colleague with me here this evening, Carol Purcell, who heads the drug diversion initiative at the University of Michigan Health System. But it also includes things like what is the waste stream, waste management. How is it that we remove this huge excess of opioid medications, the very presence of which places us and our children at risk. An important point, most kids who use opioid medications for the first time, they do not get them from dealers, they do not get them from the internet, they get them from your medicine cabinet. As a result of that, we'll talk a bit about some drives, and we'll let you know about some resources available, including the Red Barrel Project. These are some of the things that you can learn about through the website. Where do you go to take your discarded medications? Because most of us are prescribed far more than we ever need. The most recent suggestions from the CDC is that most patients, for example, after oral surgery or a treatment episode, probably only need opioid medications for about 2 or 3 days. That if we need them for more than 5 days, we probably need reassessment. And yet the vast majority of prescriptions, as we all know, are much, much higher than that. So if you're given a prescription for 30 tablets and you've only taken 2 or 3, that's 27 that are sitting around that could find themselves someplace where you wouldn't like them to be. Perhaps your own kids are trustworthy, but their friends may be more curious than your own. One of the most fascinating statistics I ever heard, and this will be a little unsettling for most of us. So, you know, your medicine cabinet in your bathroom, they did a survey one time, and the result was that 80% of all people look in other people's medicine cabinets when they're in your house. When they're in the bathroom by themselves, they're looking in your medicine cabinet. So I want you to go home tonight, take a look there, and then make certain that if these are prescriptions that are expired or that you're no longer using, that they get in. Do not throw them in the trash. They need to be properly incinerated and disposed of. So diversion control, an important part. Pain patient support. We had a presentation today by a pharmacist who talked about other medications that are highly effective, more effective than opioids in treating pain, and yet many of these still remain completely unknown, even to clinicians, let alone the general public. Harm reduction. This includes, for example, helping patients receive treatment, and rather than using illicit substances, whether it's non-prescription or non-medical use of prescription medications and or heroin, to be using medications that are approved for what's called maintenance or replacement therapy. These include, for example, many of you have probably heard of methadone. That's been around for a long time. Another is buprenorphine. Addiction treatment is absolutely essential. Addiction is a medical disease. Its earlier counterpart, alcoholism, was identified as a disease by the World Health Organization in 1950 and by the American Medical Association in 1956. You'd never know it the way that our healthcare system is structured, because we tend not to look at either mental health or substance use disorders in the ways that we do other medical disorders like asthma, diabetes, or hypertension. Addiction was called a brain disease by the directors of each of two institutes of health, and that is NIAAA, the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And then probably one of the most important spokes on that wheel is what brings us all together tonight, and that is community education. So what's happened here at home, the graphs look very similar to what they do nationally, and that is that we saw a marked increase in the period from 2011 to 2014 from among Washtenaw County residents alone of 29 opioid-related overdose deaths in 2011, more than double that, 65 in 2014. You'll see the blue bars on the bottom, actually the deaths that are associated with non-medical use of prescription medications has been fairly stable throughout this time. The rash or the increase in these deaths has been associated with heroin use. And that over this time as well, fentanyl, which was not really on the map at all in the beginning of this, is now accounting for 25% or more as playing a role in these overdose deaths. Oh, let's go back just for a second now, because I want to point out some good news and part of the one of the success stories about which you're going to hear in just a moment from the panel members. You'll notice, happily, a decline from 2014 to 2015. You saw the banding that we had together, the gathering, the community gathering in August 2015. At that same month, A really innovative program was started here in Washtenaw County. It was a partnership in which our own local law enforcement agency. So when you meet this cast of characters, these are individuals who ordinarily might not mix. You might think, but they're part of a really powerful and important story, and that is that. Made available to local law enforcement officers were training and the supplying of naloxone, which is an opioid reversing agent, meaning if you administer this to someone who's in the midst of an overdose, it will reverse those that medication and save lives. This is an incredibly powerful tool. Even in that very short time from August through December, in that first year, 2014, we know that the Washtenaw Sheriff's Department had 10 franc saves by themselves. You're going to meet a champion in Lieutenant Lisa King here, who has, this woman is on fire. She has trained, she has helped make certain that officers have received training in a partnership with Dr. Gina Dahlem, who's a colleague of mine at the School of Nursing, and this has disseminated more broadly into other law enforcement agencies as well. In speaking with Officer King just before the presentation tonight, she counts 37 franc saves from the Sheriff's Department alone, and that when you think about some of the other law enforcement agencies, we know of at least 50, and I want to applaud your efforts. So in our own community, there are 50 people alive tonight who otherwise would not have been if it were not for this initiative. Now, does that mean our work is over? Not by a long shot. It's a pretty uncomfortable place to be celebrating only 49 opioid overdose deaths in 2015. That's no celebration, and this is not acceptable until, like Fred Brayson's community, they had a year with zero opioid deaths. They were at ground zero in this crisis, and their community was able to band together. They were able to make changes in laws, prescribing, treatment, saves. But there's another important part of the story, and you're going to hear about it with the panel as well. So saves are important. They're absolutely important. They're vital. I've been in addictions treatment for a long time. If somebody's dead, we can't treat them. But there needs to be more in order to be able to break that cycle of addiction, and that means having access to treatment. Treatment works. But we haven't made this anywhere near as high a priority in our national or local healthcare system as is warranted by the data. So I'll introduce to you momentarily the individuals who will be introducing themselves, speaking to you about some of the work that they've been doing. So with that, Please turn and wave. So Dr. Gina Dahlem, who I said is my colleague from the University of Michigan School of Nursing, Lieutenant Lisa King, Mr. Aaron Doyle, who is going to share some of his personal experience with you. He is one of the recipients of an opioid reversal. This is a young man whose life was saved by naloxone, and now he'll share with you what things were like, what happened, and what he's like now, and another of his partners. So he's now out there doing the work of saving other people's lives. And Ms. Ashton Marr, who is part of the RAP program, that's the Washtenaw Recovery Advocacy Project. So, as I said, on the surface, maybe an unlikely pair of partners, people who maybe at one time or another have described themselves as being an addict, being in absolutely tight partnership with law enforcement. How powerful and cool is that? While he's collecting cards, I think we can probably go ahead and get started. Immediately to my left, your right, as promised, is Dr. Gina Dahlem, who's going to tell you about how it is that she got interested in this project and what it is that she's been able to accomplish with others. Dr. Dahlem.
Thank you, Stephen. As Stephen shared, I'm on faculty at University of Michigan School of Nursing, but also I'm a nurse practitioner at the Delona Shelter, which is a residential shelter here in Ann Arbor. It is currently managed under Packard Health, but it was back in 2012 we started to see an increasing number of overdoses that were occurring in our bathrooms. And it happened that one day, one of the physicians was working at the clinic, and there was an overdose in the bathroom. She knew that it was an overdose, and she knew what we needed to do, but we didn't have the medication until the EMS arrived. And so that's what led our investigation with Dr. Molly Horstman and I to look into nationally what is the literature out there on how to respond to opioid overdoses in the community. And so that's how we started to came up on our cross in an article about a Boston in which they started a community layperson training using what we call intranasal naloxone. And I brought show and tell today, so a lot of these different naloxone prescription. And so this is what we've been doing since 2013. We trained our Delona staff and providers, and we actually, it was the front office medical staff, our MA, has used naloxone 4 times to reverse opioid overdoses in our shelter. And as a result of that, in 2014, when Governor Snyder signed the law in which, part of the Good Samaritan law in which we were able to prescribe to, you know, family and friends, as well as to give immunity in good faith for people who are calling for help for opioid overdoses. And so that's when we started our training, our first responders. And I think because Delona Shelter was one of the early adopters of this intranasal naloxone, that's how I got involved with Lieutenant Lisa King and Ashton, as well as the training manager, Eric Waddell, along with our former Washtenaw County Medical Director, Alice Penrose, to develop our training for the Sheriff's Department. And so just to give you a quick training right now, is this is what we teach. So this is the medication itself. It comes in a speech box, and then this is a nasal atomizer that is provided in this little red bag, the naloxone bag. And what you need to do is just take off all the caps. There's a purple cap on the medication, and this is glass. So we always advise the officers and the first responders, do not bite off the cap. And then all you need to do is screw on the medicine onto the atomizer and attach the nasal atomizer to the medication, to the delivery device, and then you spray. And you get this nice fine mist. And the main thing is, this is intranasal, meaning it must go into the nose, not the eyes, the ears, the mouth, in the nose. And that's all they have to do. And so half the medication goes into one nostril, and the other half goes into the other nostril. And so since we first started to train the Sheriff's Department in August 2015, within the first 2 weeks, we had our first officer that was able to use naloxone to reverse an opioid overdose. And since then, we've had requests and requests to train. We knew that it was going to go wildfire after the first save. And so I think so far we've trained over 400 first responders.
I think it's up to 450.
Yeah. 450 now. Lisa keeps the stats.
Outstanding. Thank you.
So I'm Lisa King, and first of all, thank you so much for all your help, because she's my partner in the training. So whenever we have new trainings coming in, she's like, okay, let's go. So even requests down to Monroe County to train Dundee's police department. So we're even getting requests out of Washtenaw County to help other police agencies. I'm the Western Washtenaw County Lieutenant, so I cover everything from US 23 to the Jackson County line. And when Sheriff Clayton wanted us to move forward with this plan, I was kind of designated as going to be like the lead trainer with Gina to go ahead and get all of our officers trained. You have 3 months, and I want every single person that's on Road Patrol staff to be trained. okay, and we have to change their stigma to go out and help and get everybody into recovery once they have an overdose and change all the officers' opinions. So we, since August 2015, we have trained all of our road patrol staff, all of our command staff, corrections staff who work for intake into the jail in our ITR. We've trained our court security staff. So if you go into one of the Washtenaw County court buildings, all of the court security staff have been trained in naloxone as well. We have trained all of our juvenile detention staff because there's not an age that you can put for who's going to be using heroin. We also have trained all of the community mental health staff that go out and work with clients in the field, so they have been trained. We've trained Eastern Michigan University Police Department, Ipsy City Police Department. We did a train the trainer and trained officers with Ann Arbor City Police Department, University of Michigan Public Safety. We trained all of Saline Police Department and Dundee Police Department. I think that's it. Oh, University of Michigan security for the museum. So, I mean, I think we're hitting most places. We have a couple more police departments still to finish in the county, but we're working on it. One of our big goals, though, in our agency is completely changing, and our officers are, after a year, we're finally getting into the piece that we really need to have, is the recovery piece. So once we have an overdose, The biggest thing with having our deputies have the naloxone is because 9 out of 10 times our deputies are on scene faster than Huron Valley Ambulance. So for us to be on scene and there's a victim, before we would stand there and there's nothing that we can do. So now we're able to render aid and save somebody's life where we're not waiting 5 or 6 or 7 minutes while somebody's dying in front of us and we can't help them. So once the person comes back, then what we do now is we reach out to the Home and New Vision and also Don Farms, and we start that recovery piece. And then we also have outreach workers with the Sheriff's Office, and I will let Aaron and Ashton talk about that. But we now have our internal recovery piece as well. So we reach out to our outreach workers as well to start the conversation of recovery with the victims that we have just recovered or saved, and so hopefully somebody's going to be reaching out to them in the hospital. So that piece is working now. And then another piece that we're working on is we have deputies on the street who have really have passion towards this, and so if they have somebody that they feel that needs help, then they will also reach out to our outreach workers, even if it's not an overdose save, but they feel somebody's suffering at the time. And they're already trying to get them involved in Home and New Vision, Dawn Farms, hooking them up with Aaron or Ashton to try to get that process started. So we're not seeing the overdose, like, and waiting until the last minute. They're trying to get them in the process beforehand.
I'm Aaron Doyle. I'm a person in long-term recovery, which means that I haven't used a drink or a drug since December 25th, 2015. And I'll just share with you a little bit of my story about how I was saved by naloxone. So like I said, the last time that I used opiates was December 25th, 2015, and I was at a friend's house, and we were hanging out in the basement, and I injected what I believe was heroin, but actually turned out to be fentanyl. And she had went out to the car, and she came back, and I was unconscious in the basement. I wasn't breathing. They called the EMS. And the next thing I know, I'm waking up. I'm soaked in water because she emptied an entire case of water on me to try and wake me up. And 2 doses of naloxone is what it took to bring me back. So I didn't know what was going on. I was completely blacked out. The EMS told me, you know, you can either go to treatment, to the hospital, or you can go to jail. And I look over and there's 2 county sheriffs. Waiting to take me to jail. So I obviously made the decision to go to the hospital where I found out I had not used heroin because they asked me what I had done. And I told them, well, I shot up heroin. And they were like, no, you have fentanyl and cocaine in your system. So apparently that was a mix of something that led me to overdose because I was heroin tolerant, for that strength of an opiate. And as Dr. Strobe was saying, fentanyl is 100 times stronger, and it's very easy to overdose. So naloxone definitely saved my life. Without it, I don't believe that I'd be here today to tell you about my story. So now I'm coming up on 2 years of recovery after I went through treatment and did outpatient treatment. And now I work with Ashton. I volunteer at the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Office. I'm a board member for the Washtenaw Recovery Advocacy Project. And our goal is to reduce the stigma of substance use disorder, to raise awareness about the disease of addiction, and to advocate for people in active addiction and help bridge that gap in services. Today I work a strong recovery program. I'm active in my community. I stay engaged, and I'm just here to help the people that are in the same situation that I used to be in, because there's no better person to learn from than somebody who's been there before and somebody that's dealt with your struggle, in my opinion. So I do something called SMART Recovery, which is a secular science and reason-based recovery program. And it works very well for me. That's another thing we do in RAP is we advocate for multiple pathways, because as people are unique, so should be, you know, people's choice in a path to recovery, because not all people are the same and not everything will work for everybody. So I do SMART Recovery because that's what works for me. And I just believe that no matter what you choose, just choose something that works for you, because when it comes down to it, we're all in this for the same reason. We're in to save lives. So it doesn't matter what program you work, as long as you're doing something that's keeping you clean and keeping you sober and, you know, saving your life, because that's really all I got.
My name is Ashton Marr. I'm also a person in long-term recovery. For me, that means I haven't had a drink or a drug in over 3 years. And a lot of what Dr. Strobe was talking about rings true with me. I definitely experimented with drugs early on, but it was in 2004 I had an emergency appendectomy, and that's when I was introduced to painkillers, and the rest is sort of history. I won't go into the grisly details of it, but I will say that at the very end of active addiction, I was sleeping in my car for weeks at a time. I weighed 30 pounds less than what I weigh today. My hair was falling out. I was miserable. I was tired, and I knew I couldn't go on like that. And treatment does work. Treatment does work. I went through treatment and several months at a halfway house, and then almost a year in transitional housing. I sort of, you know, they teach us in recovery you have to get rid of your old playmates and playthings and stay away from, they call it wet faces and wet places, because it's a slippery slope. And so I tried to do the opposite of everything that I had done in active addiction, and I happened to see this event posted on Facebook, and it was 30 local and state police and 30 members of the community getting together to discuss community relations, kind of in light of the Ferguson riots and all that. And I couldn't think of something more opposite for me to do, to be in a room with 30 police officers. And it was at 9 a.m. on a Saturday, and let me tell you what, people with substance use disorders don't typically do 9 a.m. on a Saturday very well. So I went and checked out this event, and it was great, and mostly I was just there to kind of prove to myself that I could act like a normal human being and be in the same room with a bunch of police officers, nothing to hide, you know, that sort of thing. And at the very end, this man pulls me to the side, and he just asked me, he said, you know, I know just about everybody in this room except for you, girl with the red mohawk. What are you doing here? how did you get connected with this? And so I happened to see a little pin on his lapel that had a sheriff's office thing on it. So immediately, you know, I'm trying to figure out statutes of limitations and stuff in my head, but I told him a very, very little bit of my story, and I said, well, you know, I've had some close encounters with law enforcement. I'm in recovery today. I'm doing things differently today, and I just wanted to come check out this event. And he said, well, I think I might have a job for you. And I was like, I don't want to be a narc, dude. I tend to be a very reluctant participant in my own recovery sometimes. And that's not what it was at all. It's Director Derek Jackson, and he runs the community engagement program at the Sheriff's Office. And he explained it a bit more to me. He said, no, we take people in recovery and former felons, people with lived experience, to help others who are struggling with those issues now. And I was like, well, that is something that I can get behind. That sounds interesting. I would love to do that. And it's our boss's job to help us stay on track and to do things. They've helped me go back to school. I'm a social work student at Eastern Michigan University right now. And they help me stay accountable and learn new skills and all that, helping soften up the rough edges, I guess. And then it's our job as outreach workers to help the community. So I through meeting all these different organizations and people doing great work in the community, I linked up with the Washtenaw Recovery Advocacy Project. And like Aaron was saying, we advocate for those with substance use disorders on local, state, and federal levels. We've done some incredible things that I'm just so grateful to have been a part of and to continue to be a part of. We've had two annual recovery walks. Last year it was 200 or 350 people came out. We have events called Recovery Is, which so far they've highlighted those multiple pathways that Aaron referred to. And giving people a chance to learn about those. We actually had this past summer a softball game between people in recovery and deputies from the sheriff's office.
We won!
That's the thing, is I work for the sheriff's office and I am in recovery, so I just kept telling people I don't care who wins, I win either way. Yeah, we got our butts whooped for sure, soundly. But it was fun, and it got rained out, but it was still fun. And just to be a part of something like that and to help educate the community. You know, I encounter a lot of, I guess, myths surrounding addiction and recovery and naloxone. And one of the things that has consistently come up, especially with the law enforcement officers, is well, aren't we just enabling them to go right back out and use? And I've been telling people from day one that the only thing you're enabling us to do is breathe. People can't recover if they're dead, like Dr. Strobe said. And, you know, my story is not unique. It is absolutely not unique. There are 23 million Americans in long-term recovery. When we get the support that we need, we do get better. There's always hope for us. As long as we're breathing, there is always hope for us. And, you know, I'm just so grateful to be a part of that, because I know that I absolutely wouldn't be here today if I hadn't gotten that support. So thank you all very much for coming out as well, and thank you guys so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I got a chance to preview some of these. There are some great questions. There are about 20 of these. So we will spend as much time as we can between now and 8:30. But I promise anyone who wrote a question, you do not need to leave without having it answered. And I will stay behind and answer any that we're not able to attend to in the forum. That said, I'll probably pick some that have more to do with panel members or general questions, or those that we might be able to answer a little bit quickly, in hopes that we'll get through more while we're all together here. So I'd like to start with this one, and I may be directing, but anyone can feel free to answer these as you feel so inclined and qualified. But one of the first, I think, does touch on personal stories, though. It says, can you tell when you're becoming addicted to opioids, or does it just happen?
I mean, I went through all the health classes and stuff. I started dabbling in drug use when I was a teenager, and I would say that we prosecute juveniles differently from adults for a reason, right? I don't think that I truly understood the potential consequences of what I was getting into. I had no idea how deep the rabbit hole went. And it I can't even, there were a couple of incidents where I knew that I was in real, real trouble, but knowing that I had become dependent on a substance, that I had become addicted to a substance, and being able to get help for that, overcoming that overwhelming sense of shame associated with it, and to be able to ask my very conservative, church-going family, you know, pillars of the community, to be able to admit what was going on and ask for help. Those were two huge things. I would say that I knew I was dependent when I was in the hospital for another condition, and I was on morphine, and I was still craving. It wasn't, like you said, it's heroin is stronger. And again, I at that point, I knew that things were out of control, but I didn't know what to do about that or where to go or who to talk to about it.
From maybe a more singularly medical perspective, in answer to that question, the vast majority of individuals who are now suffering from opioid-related or an opioid use disorder were innocently prescribed a prescription medication for what was a perfectly legitimate reason at that time, and over time became increasingly reliant on that until they reached a point where they realized that their use was becoming out of control. So we said, anyone, if you're kept on a dose medications, whether or not it's opioids or benzodiazepines, for example, if you put anyone on these medications for a protracted period of time, they will become what's called physiologically dependent, and if you try to reduce those doses, they can go through very uncomfortable withdrawal. So for many people, it's post-surgical, post-dental, maybe a chronic condition like back pain is often a very frequent culprit for these, but the vast majority of people who are struggling now came into this completely innocently through our own medical system.
May I add on to that real
quick? Sure.
Our disease lies to us, too. Mm. So definitely I was not in a rational state then either, but it was my truth. I truly believed that I could control it. I truly believed that I knew I could quit whenever I wanted. And I told myself that for years. That it wasn't controlling me. I was controlling the substance. It made my life better. I truly believed that. I was blind to everything else, all the other consequences that were happening until that, like, profound sense of exhaustion and misery washed over me the day that I went to treatment.
So far, either Dr. Dallum and or Officer King, for first responders, how is naloxone supplied to them? Who pays for it?
Marcy.
Yay. Mm-hmm. Actually, we have funding.
Why don't you come up to the podium so that we make sure that it gets recorded as well. So thank
okay.
you.
So we actually have funds for treatment of substance use disorders and prevention services. And we have, interestingly, a federal block grant that comes every year to the state, and then it's allocated to us. And in the past, before the Affordable Health Care Act, that block grant was used solely to help individuals get into treatment and pay for treatment services. And it wasn't a lot, and we used to run out of it pretty quickly. But with the Affordable Health Care Act and folks getting on Healthy Michigan, more and more folks were eligible for Medicaid and Medicaid-type services. So we weren't using as much of the block grant dollars. Well, you know, we have this epidemic, and we looked to the state, and we put our heads together, and we said, how can we use these dollars more effectively? And fortunately, the feds loosened up some of the strings, and so we could use those dollars to purchase naloxone. My commitment was to ensure that every law enforcement officer in the four-county region was trained and equipped, that we begin to look at how do we get naloxone into the hands of families and expand the reach of the life-saving drug. So we are using our federal and state dollars to cover the cost of that.
Great. Thank you. Officer King, if the police attends to an opioid overdose individual, will that individual be arrested after getting over the overdose?
No, not for the arrest. And I'm sorry that they gave you the option, but it is our protocol that if you are saved by naloxone, you have to go to the hospital and be treated at the hospital. Now, there may be a situation that the subject may have a pre-existing warrant for their arrest or a situation like that that has to be taken care of. However, it's our first interest to get them help at the hospital to make sure that they're not going to have a relapse and have a second or third overdose. So they're going by HVA and they're being taken up to the hospital, and the recovery groups will go up and meet with them at the hospital.
Great. Thank you.
And can I also add, though, mm-hmm. for anybody, if anybody's witnessing their friend having yes. an overdose, please call 911 because yes. they are not going to go to jail for calling mm-hmm. 911 for somebody having an overdose. We want those 911 calls to be made so we can get help there immediately.
And there was some mention of this a little bit earlier, and it does address one of the questions related to what are some of the changes in laws to help address this, and changes related to the Good Samaritan law, that you, if you help save someone or if you witness someone who needs help, please call 911. Saving that life is so important, and you will not be penalized or for having made that call. Dr. Down, can you overdose on naloxone?
No. Overdose, great question. Mm-hmm. Naloxone has been used by medical professional for the last 40 years. And so it is a safe, you can get addicted to it, you can become dependent on it, but there is a side effect of naloxone. And so I'm not sure if that's what the person is referring to. And so let's say if you're given too much naloxone, that person will experience an immediate opioid withdrawal. And so some of those immediate withdrawal effects could be some GI effects like nausea, vomiting, or agitation, and so, or even depending on the amount that was used, combative or violent behavior. But the dose that we are using to train and to deliver naloxone in these community-wide programs are regulated and low, and we have not witnessed these violent or aggressive behaviors after naloxone is being used.
So patients who are going through, it's important to know that that generally opioid withdrawal is not fatal. They may feel as if they're going to die, but they're not. And then, in fact, withdrawal from alcohol has much, much greater. That's the actually has the highest fatality. Individuals are more likely to die from alcohol withdrawal than they are opioid withdrawal.
Right now we're currently analyzing the reports from the police officers mm-hmm. that have used naloxone, and many have them reported, like what Aaron was suggesting. They come out a little bit confused, just wondering, mm-hmm. a little bit drowsy, and so it's been very effective.
So here's a good question that probably any or all of you could answer. So who's ever quickest gets to take it.
Buzzer.
So yes, we do. We need buzzers. So that's a great idea. So how do you know if a person is having an opioid overdose?
Okay. Okay. So we do this in training. And so this is part of our training that we provide for our first responders as well as community layperson. So if I share with the audience, if you call the person's name out loud, "Hey, Joe," and the person responds, well, they're not in an opioid overdose, okay? But, however, if the person does not respond in a loud voice and you see signs of shallow breathing, respirations less than 10 minutes, blue lips, blue fingernails, right, lack of oxygenation, as well as unconsciousness, as well as what we also train responders to do is to give a sternal rub. So you make a fist, and then you rub the sternum right here in the center. And if they don't respond to that painful stimulation, then you can suspect that person is in an opioid overdose. And a lot of times, when you are in a scene of an opioid overdose, it does not occur in isolation. And so there are friends, there are people around that person that could help you as well. And a lot of times when officers come in, they already see that someone has been using or there are drug paraphernalia. So that's also another sign that they have been using. And so the biggest thing is that they're not responsive to painful stimulus. They're not breathing or gasping for breath. As well as blue lips and fingernails. And then they, the officers a lot of times describe this agonal breathing where there's like a death rattle. And so those are the first signs that you see.
Good. Excellent answer. Thank you so much. I'll take this one. Is the opioid epidemic a global issue, and does that exceed the national epidemic? So just last month I had the honor of being on an international panel at an educational conference for the International Nurses Society on Addictions. And so I was representing the U.S. perspective, but we had representatives there from Brazil, the U.K., Canada, Israel, the Netherlands. America likes to be first and best, and that absolutely pertains to our use of opioids. So that although we only account for 5% of the world's population, we account for more than 80% of all the opioids that are consumed around the world. 5% of the population, 80% of opioids. And then in answer to the question, it depends on which areas or countries. So, for example, my colleague from Brazil said that the opioid prescribing is so tight, access is so low in his country of Brazil that opioids are not a problem there. They, however, are currently undergoing one of the same seizures that we experienced back in the 1980s. Their problematic drug at present is crack cocaine. In other countries that, opioid use may be a problem, but not to the same magnitude as it is here in countries including Canada and the UK. Interestingly, there are some widely divergent approaches in terms of harm reduction or treatment modalities in certain other countries that it would be considered anathema here in the United States, where the prevailing model continues to be abstinence and that many people are resistant even to opioid replacement therapies. So, for example, in the Netherlands, they have supervised heroin smoking clinics that are staffed by nurses, and patients come in and receive the drug on a supervised basis. This one is a pretty quick one, too. It says, do these stats, and I assume that it means the opioid overdose deaths, do these stats include suicide attempts? For the most part, to the degree that whenever people are able to, when we're able to tell when there are signs in terms of the national data, no, they do not, these are not intentional suicide. So these are overdoses that are far and away, the vast majority are completely accidental. I'll throw this one out, and as a default, I can take any of these, but I also don't want to be, I don't want to be greedy. So why isn't Vivitrol, and Vivitrol actually is called naltrexone. So it is also an opioid antagonist. So it blocks the brain's ability to use opioids. So why isn't Vivitrol more widely discussed and available, and why is it so expensive?
Should we have Marcy answer?
Well, I can. So we are looking into the expansion of using Vivitrol as part of our treatment regimen.
Just for a second?
Yes.
So one of the potential benefits from Vivitrol is that it's available in a once-a-month injectable long sustained release. So a patient, if he or she has one injection per month, it blocks the effects if he or she takes opioids. And so it, and The other piece is it's not an opioid agent itself, so that even individuals who subscribe to an abstinence-based model, this does not counter that or conflict with their philosophy. So, sorry, just wanted to talk about the pharmacokinetics for a moment.
So it's very expensive. It costs a little over $1,000 a month, so the medication is costly. It is on the Medicaid formulary, so folks with Medicaid can access it. The part of the problem is the physicians needing to prescribe. You need to have a physician manage the medication portion, and there are not a lot of physicians out there that are readily using Vivitrol as part of providing that service for folks. And when we do work it out, we want to make sure that folks are engaging in treatment services, because anytime you want to give a medication to assist treatment, you also have that treatment component. So we're really working on developing access to it and ways that we can ensure that we're expanding the use of it. So Vivitrol is one of those medication-assisted treatments that we have access to, but not a whole lot at this moment. We also have access to Suboxone and also methadone clinics here in Washtenaw County.
Thank you, Marcy.
May I add on to that, too? Mm-hmm. Actually, for the first year of recovery, I was on the pill form of naltrexone, and it did help quite a bit with cravings. I remember sometimes people, particularly in early recovery, will suffer from using dreams, and they can be very vivid and very traumatic and shocking to wake up to when you're trying to recover. And so I noticed far fewer using dreams. Like I said, I was on it for about the first year of recovery, and I would say it's a very effective tool. It provides a bit more another wall between myself and my drugs, but it wasn't, you know, I still had to have a program of recovery. I still had to get connected with the recovery community and recovery supports, and it came down to, am I going to take this pill every day? And that's what I see a lot with loved ones of people with substance use disorders, is they don't know that their loved one is taking the pill every day. So then Vivitrol can be very useful, because it is once a month. You know they've gotten the shot.
Great. Thank you. Officer King, given the liaison between this law enforcement and this program, it sounds like this one's for you. Do you teach any of this in fifth grade DARE programs? Well, let's take that one first. Is this part of the DARE program?
So we teach TEAM right now, teaching, educating, and mentoring. And Deputy Wyan teaches this throughout some of our schools in Washtenaw County. So she does touch on drugs a little bit, and I do not believe she touches on naloxone. I know that was not in the curriculum a couple of years ago, but that could have changed. So I do not believe so at this time. But I know she does touch on drugs. It's just I do not believe she touches on naloxone.
Good. Thank you. This one can be for any and all, including Marcy and me. So,
Chair Marcy.
Here we go. Chronic pain is a central component to the opioid epidemic. Given that opioids are clearly not the best option, and that there is evidence that mindfulness and cognitive therapy have been shown to work as an effective alternative, but this type of therapy can be resisted or hard to access. What are clinicians offering as an alternative to opioids, or how are they effectively communicating the efficacy of alternatives?
Okay. Running up and down. So we have a wide array of services, especially partnering with the folks in the recovering community and using peers, case managers to assist folks in getting their basic needs met, because those are stressors. We are also, we use group therapy. We have a wide array of levels of care, outpatient services, therapists, and we have what we call withdrawal management, which is the new term for detox services, residential, So there's an array of mix and match, and really what we want to do is layer the kinds of opportunities that folks get. You may be able to go to an outpatient treatment program, but you also may have a case manager and a peer working with you. Those seem to be the most successful, and if we add on a medication-assisted treatment, for example, Vivitrol or some other medication, we're really kind of slamming the opportunities for those individuals, if you will. Did I answer the question?
Mm-hmm. So that in many cases, it's not a single therapy that we're looking at. So I'm colleagues with addictions experts from across the country, and there are some specialized programs in the U.S., and that for individuals, even those who have chronic pain and have concurrent substance use disorder, more often than not, then the movement is toward, in a very controlled way, being able to wean them off or detoxify them from the opioid medications. And during that time, then, to be offering an array of alternative treatments. Many of these will include, for example, mindfulness-based treatments. So mindfulness-based therapies have been some of the first applications were with chronic pain patients. So this has been around for about a quarter century. In trials, it's been shown to be effective across an array of different disorders, including pain, specifically, anxiety, depression, as well as addictions. And that's a holistic mind-body approach to treatment. We're coming near the end of our time, and I want to make certain that people have some familiarity with the resources. We don't want you to just walk out of this room and past some very important people and resources that are available to you. So in addition to those that are being hosted by the Depression Center and Bright Nights, there are also some representatives here on behalf of the Washtenaw Health Initiative Opioid Project. One of the things that we would be interested in is finding out who among you might be interested in learning more about naloxone and how to yourself become trained. So there'll be individuals taking that information. In addition, we want to make sure that each and every one of you walks out of here with a card that has the website address for the Opioid Project, and those cards are available out on the tables. In addition, if there are individuals, many times we'll have other professionals or citizens who say, you know, what is it that I can do to help? And so if you are inclined to want to volunteer, remember, we're all here on our own time and our own dime. This is a volunteer organization, and in order for us to be effective, we really do need buy-in from the community at large. You know, a few dozen people aren't going to make the difference when you saw those staggering statistics about what it is that we're up against. So if you think that you might be interested, we're not going to make you sign a contract now, but if you'll give us your name and an email address and maybe one of the areas in which you're interested, we won't bother you over the holidays, but sometime between, you know, maybe with the beginning of the new year, contact you and see see if there are ways that we could use your skills, your time, and your talents, and your services. Remember, one of the most important things that you can do, go home tonight. Take a look in your medicine cabinet, because if you aren't, your neighbors and your guests are, remember. See what's in there, and if it's an expired medication or if it's one that you have not needed, please dispose of it properly. That can be at one of the Red Barrel Project locations. Increasingly, pharmacies are taking back medications. In our community, we're very happy. We've had a number of very successful drives in drug take-back programs. And my understanding, someone can correct me, what was the total amount that this community had collected? It was a staggering amount. I think we all...
We had a ton?
We were, I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of three quarters of a ton of medications that had been turned in and then are taken out, really, essentially out of our communities and stream. These are medications that otherwise can and may be misused and starting people on the wrong track. So with that, as I promised, if we didn't get to your question, I have just a few or several of those remaining. I'm willing to stay behind and entertain those for anyone who wants to talk afterwards. Beyond that, we really thank you. We do not want the Washtenaw Health Initiative Opioid Project to be a secret. We want everybody in this community to know who we are and what we are and what we do, because we're part of your community. You're part of this initiative. One last thing in terms of potential volunteers. If there's anyone in here who fancies himself or herself to be a webmaster, boy, have we got a project for you. So you make sure you identify yourself specifically that way, and you'll be given regal treatment, I promise you. All right? Marcy?
Also a videographer.
Okay. Great, thanks. So with that, I want to thank you. I want to commend all of you for coming out, being part of this community education initiative this evening. And please help me thank all of our panel members as well.